Garantiert. So one little teaching or suggestion, practice suggestion I wanted to give, and some of you have heard this before, is that when the bell rings, don't move right away. Actually, enjoy that moment. It's the moment, really, of kind of release, where if you've been kind of efforting or just waiting for the bell or trying to make something happen, it's like, ah, okay. And it can be a really sweet moment, and one to be enjoyed. And it's just a moment then of mindful listening. So listening to the bell. I usually take some time picking out the bells that I use. So try to find ones that have either pleasant or interesting overtones to them. So listen, there's multiple tones in there. And that just kind of gives you a sweet, sweet moment. Tonight I'm going to talk about a traditional Buddhist teaching which ties in very directly with addiction and recovery, which might be true of practically every Buddhist teaching. My friend Vimalasara says that Buddhism is the original treatment program, 2,500-year-old treatment program, treating the addiction to self. And this teaching, though, is called Gratification, Danger, and Escape. And it's got several dimensions, I think, that will allow us to sort of explore some interesting places with it. So I'll read a little bit of one of the suttas where the Buddha talks about this. And it's in somewhat of a cryptic teaching originally. So he uses the term bhikkhus, which is the Pali word for monks. Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was just a bodhisattva, which is Pali for bodhisattva, bodhisattva or bodhisattva is someone who's essentially striving for enlightenment in the Theravada tradition. In the Mahayana has a different definition. But before my enlightenment, while I was just a bodhisattva, not yet fully enlightened, it occurred to me, what is the gratification in the world? What is the danger in it? What is the escape from it? Then, bhikkhus, it occurred to me, the pleasure and joy that arise in dependence on the world, this is the gratification in the world. That the world is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, this is the danger in the world. The removal and abandonment of desire and lust for the world, this is the escape from the world. So gratification, danger, and escape. So in other suttas, the Buddha goes into more detail about gratification, and he focuses on the sensual pleasure. He talks about the gratification that can be experienced through the five sense doors. And then he talks about how unsatisfactory that is, though. And as he says here, it's because of impermanence, also because of desire, that desire leads to suffering, and then says, when we see this, we see, oh, there's pleasure to be had, right? Which is, we know as addicts, right? That's how we became addicts. It's one of the ways, one of the things that caused it. We had a drink, we had a drug, we had a food or sex or whatever it was that we were drawn to. And there was pleasure in it, right? We did not see the danger, right? which is why we became addicts. At least it's one of the reasons we became addicts. So in recovery, the beginning of recovery is, in a sense, seeing this truth that there is danger and that there is an escape. That it is unsatisfactory. That our addictive behavior or the substance or behavior just did not satisfy us, didn't solve the problem we were trying to solve. And then the escape then is the program. And the 12 steps is the 12-step program. And other programs, it's, you know, following in refuge recovery, recovery dharma, it's following the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So in Buddhism, it's really following the Eightfold Path. That's how we escape. That's how we let go. I mean, it's very simple when the Buddha says, well, I just abandoned that. Well, okay, but how did he abandon it? That's the question. And the answer, of course, is this path, this Eightfold Path. So we can see how that connects directly to addiction and that to maybe to take that apart a little bit through the lens of the steps. You know, the step one is this admitting we were powerless, that our lives are unmanageable. So that's really seeing the danger that it doesn't work. And then the step two suggests that we have to believe that there's a process for escape. So we wouldn't engage in this process unless we believed it could bring about some relief, some escape, if you will, the escape from the suffering. And then step three is sort of committing ourselves to that path. And step four is the beginning of uprooting the past karma. Maybe I should talk a little bit about that. We've been talking about sort of how we the cause and effect in addiction and in recovery. So the Buddhist principle is that any kind of change or transformation has to come about through a variety of forms of action, through changing thoughts, words, and deeds, which are the three ways that we create karma. So the third step is kind of committing to change, but I'd say it's not really, nothing really gets accomplished, because when we make this decision, it's kind of like sitting down to meditate. I'm going to sit down and meditate and get focused on my breath. And we do that, and instead the mind wanders off. Right? So we realize, oh, there's more work to be done. So in the 12 steps, we realize that this uprooting is going to be an examination of past karma, which is the searching fearless moral inventory, and then the effort to transform that karma, which I would argue is what step seven is, that we don't actually, there's not an external force that, you know, surgically, psychic surgery removes our shortcomings, but rather that we actually take the steps then to change. We create the karmic conditions for change to happen. This is very similar to what happens in meditation. So the gratification, danger, and escape is also what happens through our practice, through our meditation practice. And here it's maybe more subtle. Whereas with addiction and with sensual pleasure, it's something external and behavioral. that can be sort of changed through just through actions, through external actions. When we sit down to meditate, we're facing the subtler form of karma, which is the mental karma. And this is what creates the struggle for us. So Ajahn Amaro, who's been one of my teachers, has a wonderful book called The Breakthrough. And here he talks about how we create suffering, how we, the kind of danger in the mind. Well, and I'm going to go back actually to another sutta first. So when the Buddha first starts to teach, what's said to be his first Dharma talk, I'm practicing saying this, the Dhammacakkappavana Sutta, that's not quite it, close, is the setting in motion the wheel of Dharma. And here he is where he first describes the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So I'm going to be losing all sorts of things off here, but that's okay. So for those who aren't familiar, I'll give a brief kind of overview of the Four Noble Truths, but I want to focus on one of them. The Four Noble Truths are the truth that there is suffering, that there's kind of this unsatisfactoriness to life, which is related to this idea of the danger. And then the second noble truth is the cause or the origin of that suffering, which the Buddha says is three forms of craving. Craving for sensual pleasure, this craving to be or to become, and the craving to not be or to unbecome. And the third noble truth is the cessation of suffering, or that is that if we stop this craving, that suffering ends. And then the fourth noble truth is the way to do that. That becomes the Eightfold Path, which will probably be another talk this week. I want to read to you what the Buddha says about the second noble truth. He says, "Now this, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving which leads to renewed existence accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there, that is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for extermination." Again, a teaching that's not transparent in its meaning at first glance, but one which rewards us if we go deeply into it. Well, we can see pretty clearly, we can understand this, and again, related to addiction, that the craving is actually where the suffering comes. You know, it's that wanting, that sense that it's not enough, that I need more. And we experience it, you know, in the dining hall. You know, we experience it in our daily lives, even in recovery. But this point about the craving for becoming, this is a more subtle idea. So here, Ajahn Amaro connects it to our meditation practice very directly. So he says, where did I have this? The subtle kinds of craving are the ones that cause more trouble. There is the desire to become enlightened, the desire to be concentrated, the desire to attain jhana, which is the deeper concentration states, the desire to develop insight, the desire to get rid of your defilements, the desire to get rid of your chattering mind and stray habits of thinking. Does that sound familiar at all to anyone? Now you might ask, but aren't we supposed to do all those things? You look at the list of good qualities we're advised to be developing jhana or develop insight or getting rid of defilements, getting rid of greed, hatred, and delusion. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? And when we look at the text, we can see that certainly the Buddha in his teachings regularly stresses the problematic nature of greed, hatred, and delusion and the blessings of concentration and insight and wholesome conduct. So it can be confusing. How can it be that wanting to become enlightened, wanting to become concentrated, wanting to attain insight, wanting to get rid of defilements, how can that be a problem? How can it be an obstruction? So I would say, how can this be the danger? Well, this is where bhava tanha, so bhava tanha is the desire to become, and vibhava tanha, the desire to not become. This is where they come in and how they become a cause for more suffering. Because when the heart is caught in that becoming, there is always a sense of self involved. Although it might look as if we're following the instructions given in the texts, or we're trying to do the right thing by following the guidance of the teacher, if there is that me and mine, then we're in the grip of those presences of bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. It's me trying to be concentrated. It's me trying to enter jhana, me trying to develop insight, me getting rid of my defilements, me trying to quiet my chattering mind, me trying to become a stream enterer, me. And that can be so familiar, so common, so ordinary, so unremarkable that it can take all the effort being made. It can take over all the effort being made. The whole effort and intention can be comprised by that I-making and mind-making habit. We're not aware. We think we're doing all these wholesome things and carrying out the practice and following the instructions. But unconsciously and unknowingly, we are feeding the causes of suffering. We're feeding the sense of self. We're building more of a quality of self-view. So we can see how this happens, right? This is a really recognizable experience. And it's that paradox or that conundrum we run into. We came here to get better at meditating, you know, or to have a nice, peaceful time, or to develop some insight, to work through some of our issues, to solve some things, right? But what is that? It's all of it is craving. It's all me wanting to control, wanting to get certain things that I've determined that that's what I need to do. What I really need, do you ever say that to yourself? What I need is, I need to meditate more. I really need to go on a retreat. It's just what I need. No, it's not. It's what you want. It's what you crave. You crave something. So this is the great challenge of practice. So Ajahnamurō then shifts to talk about right effort, which is what this is about, ultimately. And this is really a great topic for the first night of a retreat. And one of the things that I became aware of some years ago was that almost every question that someone asked me about meditation was really about right effort. How do I do it? But underneath that question was always, how do I control it? How do I get what I want? Tell me the trick. Tell me the magic. Tell me, you know, the thing you've been holding back, right? We know there's a secret. Didn't you think that? I know when I first started to meditate, I thought, like, there's some magical thing that's going to happen. Yeah. When I first took a meditation training, it was transcendental meditation, which really, just its name right away, you're like, woo, I'm going to transcend all that shit. And I was like, oh, okay, here it is. And they like whisper in your ear, here's your mantra. You know, and they tell you that, well, we met with you and we looked at your personality and we picked out a special mantra for you. This is just for you. Don't tell anybody what it is. Now, around 1982, I was working for a magazine distributor in Venice Beach. And one of his magazines he carried was Omni Magazine. Now, Omni Magazine at that time had an article revealing that the mantras, as they were given in TM, were given to you by your age. People from 18 to 24 were given one mantra. People 24 to 29 were given a different mantra. 29 to 30, that's not the exact years, but you get the idea. It was just, that was a disappointment. By then, of course, I was a Buddhist, so I didn't mind. In fact, I reveled in it. You know, all those suckers, you know. Anyway. Now, TM's a great practice. It's just that, you know, that's that part of it's a hoax. I'm having so much fun, I forgot where I was. I'm back in the garage, Venice Beach, with the magazines, ripping the covers off the magazines. So right effort becomes the challenge. What's the magic of right effort? And again, the Buddha gives this very, you know, specific teaching. You know, avoid the unwholesome that hasn't arisen. Abandon the unwholesome that has arisen. Cultivate the wholesome that has not arisen. Maintain the wholesome that has already arisen. Four great efforts. Okay, let's get in there and do it. Right? Oh, wait. There I am. There I go again. I am doing it. Striving. Right? So, Ajahn Amaro puts it really well about how to work with this. In the practice, learning to recognize when the mind is applying right effort and the practice is being guided by wisdom, by mindfulness, there's a particular quality or tone. Effort is being made, but it doesn't have a compulsive or driven quality to it. There's no obsessiveness. When effort is guided by becoming, by bhava, there's always something of a tone of compulsiveness. The I, me, and mine element is in there. We have to become familiar with what those two different qualities are like. Now that's one of the key things that we are doing here, becoming familiar with what those two different qualities are like, the quality of mindful effort and the quality of grasping effort. The quality of wanting effort. And so this is why, you know, I talked this morning, one of the reasons I talked this morning about getting that broader perspective. Sometimes we're in very close, right? We're trying to pay attention to the breath, but it can be with this kind of trying to cling to the breath, trying to get it. You know, I know that if I can just be with my breath, then it'll be the way it's supposed to be, whatever that is. I don't know what it is, but I'm sure that's what it is because that's what they said to do. And then we find the mind just keeps going off, and you're in 1982 in the garage, and you know maybe you weren't alive in 1982. You're off somewhere else, right? Or you're out in the future, and you just, come back. What's wrong? I must be doing it wrong. I should probably pay closer attention to the breath. And when we find ourselves in that place, sometimes we just have to stop, open up and realize, wow, what is this energy? And that's when you tune in. You shift your attention from the breath to the feeling tone. Oh, that's the tone of craving. That's the tone of wanting, of obsessive, of bhava tanha, of I chasing something for me so that I can become a good meditator. It's a contradiction, really, in terms. If I am meditating, then I am not a good meditator. I can't be a good meditator. I can't be a good meditator. There can be pleasant meditation. There maybe even can be good meditation. I don't know. But it can't be me doing it. So we step back and we feel that, ah, that's what that feels like. Okay, well, what does it feel like to not be doing that? And we start to search for it. So one of those moments is that moment when the bell rings. That's one of those moments. That's why I want you to feel that, because there's no effort after the bell rings, right? You stop striving. Ah, it's over. Ah. Oh. Are you spacing out? No. You're relaxed. You're listening to the bell. It's all good. Just a taste of that. Okay, I think I'm starting to see this. You know, I had my real breakthrough with this on the 3-month retreat in 1981. And I had been doing the noting practice Linda mentioned this morning. I had been doing that devotedly, not to say obsessively, but close. And that was that's a practice that it comes through the Burmese Mahasi Sayadaw method, very well respected form of practice and a really valuable form of practice, but it has this potential because it's so systematic. We take systems, right, and we try to make them work for us. Well, if I'm doing this system, then it should work. And week after week, you know, day after day, week after week, sitting after sitting, I'm, noting everything in, out, thinking, wanting, hearing, and lifting, moving, placing. And it's this sense, this wrong view that I had, this delusion that if I could just note everything, that then somehow the meditation would start to work, and it didn't. It got more and more painful. And at a certain point, I gave up. And I don't know if I can say as soon as I gave up, but soon after giving up, something else opened up, and I realized that I didn't need to be striving like that. Now, when you've been in silence for several weeks or a month or two, you don't really need to make much effort. You know, it just kind of, there's just a dropping in. But it allowed me to sense what that felt like. And it that continues to inform my practice today, because really what I experienced was these two different feeling tones that Ajahn Amaro was talking about. I realized I'd been experiencing this bhava tanha, I didn't have it in those terms at that time, but this stressful efforting. And then I also realized, oh, I can feel this other way of being. So once I had tasted that, I could always recognize the difference. And this is what you want to develop in your practice here. I hope that if you haven't, I think many of you have already experienced this, but for those who haven't, this is one of the things to kind of look for this week, to, continue to show up, continue to do your practice and to make an effort, but notice when that effort becomes tight, and also notice if there's moments when it kind of becomes loose and comfortable and you're still awake and engaged. Because the risk, of course, when we relax and just sort of stop making effort is that we just sort of fall into a dull stupor, the famous sloth and torpor. But with time, this is one of the ways that we become what you could say call a skillful meditator. I wouldn't call it, say you're a good meditator. It's just that you become skillful at it. And it doesn't mean by any means that every time that you meditate that you're clear and focused and alert. And it just means that you're not caught so often, that you detect the danger more quickly. This is kind of the what we're trying to discover. So I often talk about our practice as exploring the landscape of our mind, getting to know the landscape of our mind. So this is an aspect of that, is discovering where effort becomes striving and where it becomes escape, in the positive sense of escape, in the Buddha's words, the escape. I think that's going to be suffice on that. So I promised I would, I don't know that I promised, but I mentioned that I would share with you a little from the Satipatthana Sutta. The question this morning being, should we be mindful all the time? And actually that question, what was underneath that question, relates very directly to what I've been talking about. Because in that question by that anonymous questioner, the end of it, the last word in it was exhausting, right? And why is it exhausting, right? Because there's a striving in it, right? There's nothing exhausting about being mindful, right? Mm-hmm. It's striving to be mindful, that's exhausting, you know? Mm-hmm. Trying to be mindful. Mm-hmm. But if I'm not trying, how am I going to be mindful? Mm-hmm. Well, this is what Suzuki Roshi calls the secret of practice. And then he leaves it at that. You're like, oh, well, okay, what? But this is exactly what I'm talking about. That we can only find it through our own experience. It can be described to us, and how to detect it. And I would say it's easier to describe the grasping aspect of it than it is to describe the letting go aspect. But you have to discover it for yourself. And that's why, you know, I sit up here and sort of have this role as, you know, the teacher on the retreat. But really, Greg and I are more sort of, for lack of a better phrase, holding the space. You know, if there's nobody up here, you know, maybe you don't show up for the sitting, you know. Like, we create sort of a responsibility for you in a way. But the work is all yours, you know. We can't, I mean, I'm not codependent, so I won't say that I wish I could do it for you. But you know, I'd like to be able to be of more help, but I really can't. You know, I just can't get in there. I don't know how to psychically get into your mind and say, shh, no, over here, go over there. No, away, no, stay away from that. No, there you go again. No, over here. You wouldn't listen anyway. You don't listen to yourself. You know? So why would you listen to me? But this is the practice, right? And why do we have to do it for days and days and days? You know, for people who are really new to practice and they accidentally come on a retreat, and they're, why are we meditating so much, you know? I mean, at home I just meditate for 20 minutes. That's fine. But the thing is that it's through the repeated practice that you start to discover these subtleties, right? You start to see this stuff. You have to see it over and over. You kind of have to get banged over the head, right? Oh, there I go again. Fell for that one, you know, the gratification and the danger. I keep falling into those habits because they're so deeply ingrained. They're so hard to uproot. I mean, that's why they talk about it taking many lifetimes to become enlightened. I don't know what that means or if that's true, but it sort of makes sense, at least on a metaphorical level, that we have to just keep at this. You know, again, it comes back to the steps as well. You look at step four, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory. Great. Step five, we, you know, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being. You know, we share it. Step six, we're ready to have the defects removed. Step seven, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Okay. Okay, we're getting there now, right? Step 8, I made a list of those I harmed, made, you know, and then step 9, I made direct amends to them. Whew, done. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Well, what's that saying? It's saying, you're not done. Don't think you're done. Just because you had an insight, just because you got through this part of the process, the conditioning, the karma is deeply embedded. We're not becoming different people. You know? Our personalities, I mean, this is one of the things, you know, that exercise we did this afternoon, you're looking at your sort of your past karma, the positive past karma, you were remembering that you weren't really a different person then, right? Yeah, your actions, your behaviors are different. A lot of things shift, but there's these kind of core elements, and that some will never get uprooted, and some of them, the best we can do is transform them into positive qualities, and kind of bring out the positive side. But we're not all of a sudden, you know, I'm not gonna grow back a head of hair and, you know, what else, grow 3 inches taller and play shortstop for the Yankees. I mean, it's, you know, that's just not going to happen. Maybe that was a bit of a digression, but, you know. So we practice in this way throughout the day, and we don't practice mindfulness to be good boys and girls or others, you know, we practice to try to uproot this karma, try to transform this karma. And that's a very lofty kind of goal. So I'd rather say we practice in order to stop falling into that pit each time. We practice to stop getting caught by the danger, and to stop believing it every time that thought or that wish or that want comes up, that we are able to see, oh, there's that, you know, and that aversion, oh, it's okay, that we gain perspective. So this is from the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and this section is called Full Awareness. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping it silent. So all the rest of the time you can skip being mindful. But again, it's not to do this to be good, but because of the insight that arises through that, and essentially that we see how we create suffering for ourselves, and we let go of that behavior, the internal, external behavior, all the forms of it. So let's just sit for a moment and relax. Sometimes the most precious moments on a retreat can be the little spaces and you're walking to the hall through the dawn light, and you stop for a moment and just breathe in the cool air. When you're sipping a cup of tea, when the bell rings,